This is a Vault Studios production.
1 week into the Tex MacIver trial and the only witness to the shooting of Diane MacIver, the MacIver's close friend, Danny Jo Carter, is about to take the stand.
I was upset. I was angry. I was in there all by myself and found out that my best friend died, and I was all by myself. I was scared. I didn't like being down there in that building. Nobody was around there. I was totally alone.
In her testimony, she didn't necessarily exonerate, in a sense, Tex. She just testified about what happened.
I'm Caitlin Ross. This is Intent, the Tex MacIver case, Chapter 5.
Jeff, unless Tex MacIver chooses to take the stand in this trial, this will be our only firsthand account of the shooting and the death of Diane MacIver. During the shooting, Danny Jo Carter, friend of Diane MacIver, was in the driver's seat.
Before Danny Jo Carter takes the stand in Tex MacIver's murder trial, the public hasn't heard much at all from the MacIver's close friend. She'd stayed out of the media spotlight for the most part. So when she's finally sworn in, the crowd in the courtroom is ready to hear, for the first time, Danny Jo's full account of what happened the night of Diane MacIver's death. After a few minutes of questions about Danny Jo's background and work history, Fulton County Assistant District Attorney Clint Rucker asks Danny Jo about her friendship with the MacIvers.
And can you tell the jurors, when did you become acquainted with Diane MacIver, and how you became acquainted?
I was working at a salon at North Lake, and her office was in Conyers, and I was still in school at the time, and I worked there during the week, and one of the girls asked me if I would take this client of hers that she'd gotten that wanted to come in late, and I didn't like to go in early and worked late, so I started doing Diane's nails 41 years ago.
Now, can you help the jurors understand a little bit about her personality? How would you characterize it?
Well, she was a lot of fun. She was intense. She played hard, and she could be difficult. Because she was very pragmatic about appointments, times, things that you did, how you were eating, she could be difficult.
Okay.
Along with being very loving.
Rucker then asked Danny Jo about getting to know the defendant, Tex MacIver. Danny Jo says she met Tex at a party back in 2000, before he was married to Diane. It was the night of Tex and Diane's first date. The questions continue.
When it came to Diane's finances, was she a private person about those things, or would she share her financial situations with you?
No, she pretty much kept them private.
She kept them private? Did you have any idea how much money Diane had?
No.
Would she share the intimate details about her finances with the defendant? Do you know anything about his finances?
No.
Finally, the prosecution begins to ask Danny Jo about September of 2016 and the days before Diane was killed, the trip to the MacIver's Putnam County Ranch.
Well, I was driving. Diane was probably sitting in the front seat, and Tex was probably in the. I don't remember driving down there, but probably Diane was sitting in the front because we were always talking.
Okay, are you pretty sure that you drove down there?
I'm positive I drove down there.
Okay, and why did you drive?
Because they had been drinking wine.
Mm-hmm.
Rucker then hones in on September 25th, Sunday. The day Diane was shot and killed. Diane and Tex went to play golf, and Danny Jo stayed behind. They all met back up around 6 that evening before leaving to head back to Atlanta with a plan to stop for dinner at Longhorn Steakhouse.
On the way to Longhorn, Was there any drinking going on?
Yes, there was a to-go, a roadie and a Yeti. I don't know what you call those things. The silver tumbler-like with a top on it.
And what was in it?
Red wine.
And who was drinking the red wine?
They were sharing it back and forth.
And by sharing it back and forth, they would pass it back and forth, you mean?
Yes.
How long does it take to get from the ranch in Putnam County to the Longhorn?
About an hour.
And can you tell the jury, was there drinking going on during that entire trip? How would you describe it? What do you remember?
I don't really remember how many times it went back and forth, but they were drinking it on the way there.
Okay.
Once they arrived at the restaurant, Danny Joe testifies they had to wait for a table.
I said, let's go to the bar and get a drink. So we went to the bar, and they ordered a glass of wine, and I got water.
You had water?
Yes.
Once the table was ready, they met another friend for dinner.
So what happened when the group got up to leave? Did you all get up to leave together?
Yes.
And so where did you go?
Out to the parking lot.
What happened once you got out into the parking lot?
I got into the driver's side, and Diane got into the front passenger side.
Okay. And can you tell the jury, was there some conversation about that arrangement before you got into the vehicle? Because you didn't drive to the restaurant, correct?
No.
So was there some conversation about the fact that you were going to drive back to Atlanta?
I think Diane just handed me the keys. When we left the ranch, I think she said, I'll drive to the restaurant, and you can drive from there.
In your opinion, at the time that you all got to the vehicle, did Diane appear to be intoxicated?
No.
How about the defendant?
No.
Was there any additional drinking from the Yeti that was in the car on the way to Atlanta?
I don't believe there was.
How long do you think it took for you to get back downtown?
Just somewhere around 20 minutes.
As Rucker focuses on those final minutes of Diane's life, Danny Joe moves from the witness stand to another seat, a recreation of her position in the SUV so that jurors can see clearly how things played out that night. Danny Joe then walks jurors through what happened as she and Diane and Tex made their way off of the interstate and through the streets of Atlanta.
Tex asked Diane, he said, darling, will you hand me my gun? And so she just reached over and got it. And I'm sitting here with both of my hands on and shut the console and handed it to him.
And when you were at the red light, can you tell the jurors what happened?
Well, we were sitting at the light and I hear click, click, click. And I looked at Diane and asked her what she was doing. She said, I'm just making sure the door's locked. And I heard a big boom, and I didn't know what it was. I thought there was an explosion somewhere. And I saw a puff of smoke, and I could see his hand. And I could see the top of the gun, I could see part of the gun, his hands, and some of the bag.
And what happened next?
She said, Tex, she shot me.
Did he say anything?
No. I thought it was a joke. And then I realized it wasn't. And then I knew that I had to get to the nearest emergency room. I asked Tex where the closest emergency room was.
Danny Joe testifies that Diane was breathing hard and panicking at that point. From the back seat, she says Tex leaned forward and held Diane's head. He told Danny Joe his wife was still breathing.
And I know I asked you whether or not you ever saw the defendant call 911. Did you ever see him make any phone calls during the trip to the hospital?
No, I did not.
To include, he did not call ahead to Emory and say, hey, we're on the way.
No.
Now, did he ever give you an explanation about why he chose to go to Emory?
Not me.
Rucker then asks Danny Joe about what happened as they arrived at the hospital. She says Tex got out of the car and called for help.
You saw Diane MacGyver removed from the vehicle?
Yes.
Okay. And can you tell the jurors what happened next?
They took her, I think it was in a wheelchair, into the hospital, and I sat there in the car for just a second, and I guess I just kind of switched off for a moment because it's like, well, I got here. And the valet was knocking on the window and said he could take the car.
Danny Jo then describes her movements inside the hospital, finding Tex inside near an emergency bay where Diane was at the time, then relocating to a small waiting room.
So can you tell the jurors what happened when you were in the room and it was just you and the defendant?
He said something about recalling being in Vietnam and pulling guys that were wounded out.
What was his demeanor like at this time?
Pretty calm.
How about your demeanor?
I was calm, but because I didn't want to panic, and I was afraid once I started, it wouldn't stop.
Danny Jo testifies that she found Diane's ID after searching through her purse, then found her insurance card. She took them to hospital staff, then returned to the small waiting room.
And anybody else in the room except you two?
No.
So what happened next?
He said, I need my phone. It's in the cart on the charger.
He said that to you?
Yes.
And so did you know where to go into the car to find the phone?
I knew that it was in the back seat on the charger.
Danny Jo tells the courtroom she went out to the valet and asked for the phone from the car.
So at this point, how long do you think you've been at the hospital?
15 or 20 minutes.
And when you got the phone back from the valet, what did you do?
I went back to the room, the little waiting room, to give him the phone.
Was he still there?
Yes.
Was there anyone else in the room besides you two?
No.
Did you actually hand him the phone?
I did.
And can you tell the jurors what happened next?
Well,
keep your voice up.
Okay. He was sitting down in that seat where I pointed to earlier, and I was standing up, and I handed him the phone. And he took the phone, and he started scrolling, and he said, I know this doesn't look good. And I knew he was calling his attorney, because that's what attorneys do.
After a brief objection from the defense, Rucker continues.
Let me ask you this. Did an attorney show up?
Yes.
Who showed up?
Steve Maples.
And did you know Steve Maples?
I did.
What did you know him to do as a professional?
He was an attorney.
And did you know what kind of law Steve Maples actually practiced?
Criminal.
Rucker focuses on the next critical exchange when, according to Danny Jo, Tex seems to suggest that she say something different from what actually happened.
And he said, I know. What did he say?
I know this doesn't look good.
Then what's the next thing that happened?
He looked up and didn't look at me, but looked past me and said, I don't trust these guys. Danny Jo, I hate to see you get wrapped up in this. I've seen how these things can go down.
Anything else?
You just need to say you came down here as a friend of the family.
Rucker asked Danny Jo what she said in response to Tex's suggestion.
I leaned down and said, Tex, I just drove you into the emergency room.
And why did you tell him that?
Well, because I just drove down there as a friend of the family, there was no reason for me to be down at Emory Hospital in Decatur, where I never go, with no car at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, 15 minutes after his wife had been shot. How was I supposed to explain that?
Well, you told him that, or what did you tell him exactly?
I said, Tex, I just drove you into the emergency room.
And then did he say something in response to that?
He looked at me and he says, well, they don't know that.
And so what did you say?
Well, that took my breath away.
And so then what did you say back to him?
I said, I can't lie.
And then what happened?
He said, oh, I'm not asking you to do that.
Then what happened?
I really don't remember exactly what happened right after that. I don't remember if I backed out of the room or if I went to get some water, but I can't remember.
Why not?
That really took me aback.
Danny Jo says after that conversation with Tex, she moved to another waiting room and then met with a chaplain. Later that night, with Diane McIver still in surgery, investigators from the Atlanta Police Department arrived. At one point, Diane's surgeon, Dr. Suzanne Hardy, sat down with Tex and updated him on Diane's condition. Danny Jo says they were all listening in.
She said that her heart was strong and that there was a sac that's around your heart, that it had some fluid in it, and that it wouldn't have any fluid in it if it hadn't been injured somehow. She never said the bullet hit her heart, but there was a nick out of her spleen, which was making, there was a lot of blood loss. And but she said her heart was strong, and that that she spoke. And I was very encouraged. Because she'd been unconscious.
Last time you saw her, she was unconscious?
Yes.
And did Dr. Hardy tell you the words that Diane McIver spoke?
She said.
Or did you hear her tell, because she was talking?
She was talking to everybody
in
the room. She was talking to Tex, but everybody could hear her.
And what did she say?
She said that Diane said it was an accident. And then she said, my tummy hurt. And she told us that she intubated her.
As Rucker leads her through the rest of that night, we learned that she left the hospital with investigators and spent the early morning hours being interviewed by police.
And when you got in the car with the police officers, where did you go?
Well, first we drove the route. They wanted to know exactly where we went.
Okay. And did you show them the route?
I did.
Did you show them the intersections where you believe the actual shooting occurred?
I did.
Okay. And after you showed them the route, what happened next?
They took me downtown to the police headquarters.
Okay. And then what happened?
They took me into an interrogation room, the two that drove me down there, and they sat with me for a minute. And one of them said that he was expecting a phone call and to please excuse him if he answered it.
Okay. And then can you tell the jurors, were you interviewed at that time?
Not. They started asking me a few questions. But then he got his phone call and or text or whatever and left the room. And then they both left the room.
And so can you tell the jury what happened while you were there in the room?
I got a text. My phone would text. I couldn't talk on it, but my husband sent me a text that said Diane had died.
Rucker asks Danny Jo about being at the police station alone and then learning about Diane's death.
I was upset. I was angry. I was in there all by myself and found out that my best friend died, and I was all by myself. I was scared. I didn't like being down there in that building. Nobody was around there. I was totally alone.
The next day, Bruce Harvey with Texas defense team takes over. And during his cross-examination of Danny Jo, leads her through a long, detailed description of her final trip to the McIver Ranch with both Tex and Diane.
It's another, what you would describe as a wonderful day down at the ranch.
Yes.
There was, again, nothing that indicated to you, was there, that this was a day that was any different than any other day that you had been down at the ranch?
Correct.
Okay.
The testimony goes on for hours. Danny Jo calmly answering Harvey's questions about what appeared to be the McIvers' loving marriage, what they all did and talked about that weekend. And then ultimately, he arrives at the minutes leading up to the shooting, just as Danny Jo took the exit off the interstate.
And that's when he says, "Darling," that word again, "Darling, this is a bad area. I wish you hadn't have done this." Girl, speaking to both of you.
Right? Yeah. Now he said girls.
Girls. "Would you hand me my gun? Darling, would you hand me my gun?"
Yes.
And then finally, he asks about the moment the gun went off.
"That was when you heard the boom."
Yes.
"You didn't know what happened."
No, I did not realize it was a gunshot.
"You didn't know whether or not you had been hit from the side." Or what?
I didn't know if I was going to be. I didn't know where the explosion was. I didn't know what made the noise.
Right. "You didn't know what happened. And of course, inside the vehicle, it's a loud noise, correct?"
"Very loud."
And surely it startled you and it startled, you know, everybody, correct?"
"Yes."
Danny Jo continues to answer questions, walking Harvey and jurors through the final hours of Diane's life. The scene outside the hospital, inside the waiting room, in that conversation with Tex about her not being in the car that night.
"It was just stupid, wasn't it?"
"That's why I leaned down and told him, Tex, I just drove you into the emergency room."
"Right. And you know, that was it. And he said, I'm not telling you to lie, right?"
"No."
"He didn't say that?"
"Not right then."
"Okay, but he said that afterwards, didn't he?"
"After I said, I can't lie."
"Sure, and he said, I'm not telling you to do that."
Before finishing that day, Harvey returns again to the McIvers' marriage and the love they seem to share.
"You described them as lovebirds, correct?"
"Yes."
"And that it was a relationship to be envied, correct?"
"Correct."
"And they were always talking about how happy she is, correct?"
"Yes."
"And that they were still attracted to each other, correct?"
"Yes."
"And you described, like, you know, sometimes you thought they were just going to hop in the back seat of the car."
"Yes." "Right?
And that is exactly what was the relationship that you observed between Tex and Diane on 9/25/2016, correct?"
"Yes."
The next day, the third and final day of Danny Jo's testimony, Clint Rucker decides to bring up something we haven't heard about before. He asks her about a fight between Tex and Diane that took place months earlier, when the McIvers were celebrating their godson Austin's 10th birthday at the ranch. Danny Jo says that night, Austin had burned his finger in the fire pit outside the McIvers' ranch, and when he woke up in pain, Danny Jo overheard Tex and Diane arguing.
"And can you tell the jurors, how would you describe the argument?"
"It was very heated, and Diane was saying that there was nothing wrong with him, and I was focused mainly on Austin because I knew how bad his finger was hurting because I burned my finger before like that. And Diane was saying he was all right. Tex was trying to get Diane to be quiet, and they shoved each other, and Tex kind of pushed Diane out of the bedroom and closed the door."
"In all the years that you had known them, had you personally ever seen that kind of interaction between them before?"
"No."
"And can you tell the jurors, did you speak to Diane about this incident later?"
"No."
"Did you say anything to her at all?"
"No."
"And Is there a reason why you didn't?
They were both drinking.
Danny Joe takes the stand for 3 days, 16 total hours of testimony. At one point, even telling the defense she'd been talking for so long, her memory was getting mushy. Prosecutor and 11 Alive legal expert Latonya Hines says through it all, there seemed to be something missing.
You expected to be able to get maybe a stronger feel from her of saying, I absolutely don't think that Tex meant to do this or whatever. But she just testified. It was interesting in her testimony. She didn't necessarily exonerate, in a sense, Tex. She just testified about what happened. But you knew that they were very good friends, all of them together. So I thought that was interesting. And then just seeing her demeanor walking around. I mean, she stayed quite a bit. Even after her own testimony, she was obviously very concerned about the case. But I felt like for someone who was in the car and knew them all very well, if she felt that he did not have anything to do with the, you didn't necessarily hear her be like a vehemently saying, I know Tex would never do this.
After Danny Joe leaves the stand, the court hears Tex MacIver's voice for the first time, but not because Tex himself is testifying. Rather, the jury hears a voicemail left for Danny Joe's husband, Tom, around the time Danny Joe hired an attorney to represent her.
Tom Lee is Tex. Sir, let me just be plain. Danny's about to send me to prison. Please erase this voicemail message. They're calling me right away. Y'all have no idea the problem this is causing. It's innocent, but it's absolutely good for me. Please, please call me.
Tom Carter testifies that Tex was hounding him, calling him 6 times in one day. Tom says Tex felt that Danny Joe hiring an attorney looked bad for him, and he wanted Tom and Danny Joe to come forward and tell the media Tex was innocent. Also in the witness box that day, an Emory police officer, one of the first officers on the scene when the SUV arrived at the hospital. He gives jurors another glimpse of Tex's actions inside the hospital after Diane was taken into surgery.
He told the court about a conversation he overheard in the waiting room between Tex and his friend Steve Maples, who is also a lawyer.
As he was talking, I don't remember the totality of the conversation, but I remember him saying, what do I say? What's the plan?
You remember him saying, what do I say? What's the plan?
Yes.
But you didn't hear what he said before that.
I did not.
You didn't hear what he said after that.
No.
And he's the gentleman who's at the emergency room whose wife has been shot, correct?
Yes.
The next day, day 8, the jury watches a 45-minute video of Tex being interviewed by police in the days following his wife's death. After leading detectives through the trip to the ranch and the events of the weekend, Tex describes the scene inside and outside of the SUV as they pulled off of the expressway that night. It's the first time we've heard an account of that night from Tex himself.
We went through an area of, I could describe my familiarity with it, but we went through an area I thought that was particularly dangerous. At night, I'd seen police vehicles there. It's a route I take from my office to her office.
Okay. Yeah.
And I see police vehicles there with blue lights on, and they're doing things with
right.
They're there. And
remember any landmarks or anything?
It was underpass.
Okay.
It's best I, it was very dark, but it seemed to me it was enough. That's one that has a particularly high population of homeless people,
okay.
At least in the daytime. But at night, there's a lot of people there.
Okay.
And I quickly said, this is a big mistake, and we're in a place that we don't belong.
Right.
And, of course, here we are, almost new SUV, and two women in the front seat.
Right.
So anyway, they made a couple of turns and things were not going well. And I said, we'll be on Piedmont shortly. And I said, yeah, I'd like it. If you don't mind, please hand me my friend. I was in the center console We've had some break-ins in our office where the only thing they're looking for seems to be a gun. And so I, in response to that, I had wrapped my gun in a Publix grocery sack. So if you open the console, you have no clue what you're looking at, but flashlight and some stuff like that. So Diane reaches in, pulls it out, hands it back to me. And by then, we may have been on Piedmont. Anyway, I'm relatively satisfied that we're out of the second area.
Right.
And I guess I just laid back again and went to sleep.
Okay.
This toilet was done kind of thing.
Correct.
And the weapons in my life.
Okay. And they don't remember that's happening.
Danny Joe came to a stop. And anyway, I just time to wake up. But she came to a stop, and I was handling the gun. I did not realize it was in my lap.
Right.
And it went off.
Okay. All right. When
Danny was looking for, or when she was making these turns, was she following GPS? Was she listening to anything, or just from her?
No.
No.
Diane's office is very near there. Diane's director. Right, left.
So she knew where she went, yeah, basically.
Right. My dismay was, it seemed like every turn we made, the street was darker and there were more people milling about. I mean, it was kind of rose the hair on the back of your neck.
The detectives jumped back in with questions about the exact location of where the SUV had stopped when the gun was fired, before returning again to the seconds after Diane was struck with a bullet.
I immediately called out, said, "Is everybody all right?" And Danny Joe said, "Yes." And Diane's head was kind of slanted. She said, "I've been shot," words to that effect. And I immediately put my arms around her, tried to determine what was, how bad it was. And then I made the judgment that Emory was the closest hospital. They're a client of our firm. They're a good bit. So we shot down Piedmont, crossed over Monroe, hit Morningside, went into the ER. Danny Joe driving with me, telling her the rest.
Tex continues with the events of that night, ultimately telling them about the scene at the hospital, even getting checked out himself in the Emory emergency room that night.
Yeah, I was not doing well.
Okay.
And, there it is.
Okay.
So I asked for some help, and the chaplain said I had to go through the...
Give us the time on it.
Anyway, they processed me in, you know, the ER, and you go about four different places. Anyway, I might see a doctor, and he described something called Ativan. Tell me what that is. I've never had it before. And it was 1 milligram, and I took that. It seemed to take the edge off.
Right.
But I was up. We didn't leave the hospital until 8 o'clock.
On day 9 of the trial, the prosecution focuses on one of the possible motives they introduced during their opening statement, Tex's flailing finances and his dependence on Diane's income. There's also testimony from a family friend about a pair of Diane's boots and who was wearing them after her death. The McIvers had a massage therapist, Annie Anderson, who often traveled with them and gave them both massages. And she was seen wearing Diane's boots.
Did you notice anything in particular about what she was wearing?
I did.
And can you tell the jury, what did you notice?
She was wearing a pair of rain boots that...
A pair of what?
Rain boots that my fiancé and I had given Diane for Christmas.
And it struck him as kind of odd, as what's going on here. Again, there's no evidence that there's any affair going on or relationship, but all this stuff is sprinkled into the trial in front of the jury, and it all makes you kind of think, well, is there more to the story? What exactly is going on? Why is the masseuse in the boots? Is Tex MacIver having an affair with this woman? Was this a potential motive to kill Diane? All of it kind of just thrown out there, but then no follow-up evidence to prove any of it. But it all just struck many as odd and potentially incriminating against Tex as being another potential motive and another indication of whether or not he really and truly loved Diane.
After a weekend break, the trial resumes on Monday morning, and the McIvers' finances are again the focus.
On the stand this afternoon, Ann Schwall, a friend of Tex and Diane's and the mother of their godson, Austin. After Diane was shot by Tex's gun while riding home in September of 2016, Tex updated his will to leave nearly all of his estate to their 11-year-old godson. Schwall testified that Diane McIver had wanted to leave their Putnam County ranch to Austin, but her will had not been updated since 2006, before the child was born. She also said Tex told her he was updating his will on Diane's wishes.
He told me that his biggest regret was that they did not get a chance to change their wills, update their wills.
Tex McIver's new will also left $500,000 to his oldest son, who allegedly was not interested in the ranch, while completely leaving out his other two grown children.
The following day, Harry Hudson, an Atlanta attorney, is called to the stand to testify about estate planning he'd helped the McIvers with starting in 2009. As part of that process, he'd spoken to Tex and Diane about the ranch and their wills. He testifies that the process had been exceedingly difficult, and they never reached a final decision together. During his testimony, he reads an email exchange between Tex and Diane from January 2011.
This is an email from Mr. McIver to Diane McIver on January 26, a couple minutes after Diane sent the email, and it says, "Upon what do we not NOT in caps agree?"
And about 5 minutes later, what is the response from Diane McIver back to Tex McIver?
"That I am not going to leave my half of the ranch to your estate. You are throwing money away on Friday morning, dot, dot, dot."
He's then asked to read another email where Diane is responding to an email that Tex sent her about following up with the attorney on the estate planning process.
"Could you read for the jury what Ms. McIver said in response to the email from Ms. McIver?"
"Tex, I just read this email, dot, 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 dot. Why are you going over there and wasting money until you and I decide what we're going to do upon our death? Dot, dot, dot. For you to die before me and allow me to live there until I die and then turn it over to your estate is not an option for me."
Diane did not want her half of the ranch going to Tex. Is this the motive?
"Yes, this is the motive, but it's part of the motive. All of this has to do about money, and this is one part of it."
"I don't think they proved it. It's not the motive because there is no motive because it's not a murder."
Tex leaves almost everything to Austin in his new will that he wrote after the death of Diane. Is that game over for prosecutors?
"Not at all. It's simply still again showing that he's manipulating and controlling the situation. He made the will change to make him look good."
Game was already over for the prosecutors. This is the last nail in the coffin.
Diane could have taken the ranch any time she wanted to. Is this better for the prosecution or defense?
Much better for the defense because she never made a move to take the ranch.
She could have foreclosed. She never did. It helps the defense.
Is Tex McIver better off with Diane dead or alive?
Better with her alive because she paid everything. There are no taxes he has to pay on what she pays.
He had a great life with Diane. She was paying for everything. She was lending his money. He paid whenever he wanted to. He was much better off with her alive.
That week, there's more testimony about money that Diane loaned Tex, a loan for $750,000 in 2005, and another one for $350,000 in 2011.
Tex McIver was required to pay the smaller loan in full by the end of 2017, or his Putnam County ranch would then be declared in jeopardy. The attorney for the U.S. Enterprises, who handled much of Diane's legal paperwork, told prosecutors today that Tex McIver approached him 2 days after Diane's death and was surprised by what he said.
"I expected that at that point in time he would tell me how sorry he was and how it was a terrible, tragic accident and say how much he loved Diane, but I never heard that."
Instead, he asked, Tex MacIver asked about her Social Security benefits, saying his law firm cut back his work and he was having trouble making ends meet.
Today, testimony focused on the possibility of the couple's Putnam County ranch facing foreclosure. Those close to the MacIvers say the ranch was Tex's pride and joy. He had owned the property since 1996 and added his wife Diane to the deed after they were married in 2005. The property was then put up as collateral for a $350,000 loan to Tex from one of Diane's companies. Diane had the option to foreclose on the property if Tex did not repay the loan by December of 2017, though her lawyer testified she would not have done that.
I'm not sure that that would have ever happened. Diane would have avoided that, I believe, at all costs to try to keep the marriage together, certainly. But she had that right to foreclose.
Expert testimony this afternoon revealed there was no sign Diane was taking steps to foreclose on the property at the time she was shot in September of 2016.
The picture the prosecution is painting is clear. Tex was cash poor, and Diane was supporting Tex and their lifestyle, including that sprawling Putnam County ranch that Tex loved so much.
A forensic accounting expert testified that Tex was about $5,000 in debt when his wife died. The expert said he spent nearly $63,000 more than he brought in during the 9 months before Diane was killed.
There was more money going out than coming in, and it wasn't going to savings accounts, and it wasn't going to investment accounts. It was spent on living in the ranch.
The defense says MacIver's financial problems are exactly why he would not kill his wife intentionally, because he relied on her income to fund his lifestyle.
As prosecutors continue to build their case, they prepare to shift from the MacIver's finances to Tex's guns.
It means that he's all about guns. Not one gun, two gun, three guns. You have a whole cache of them.
In the court, we'll hear directly from the MacIver's massage therapist, Annie Anderson, about those boots and her relationship with Tex MacIver.
Annie Anderson, the masseuse, testifies that that night she spent in Tex's bedroom, sleeping on the floor, just keeping an eye on Tex, making sure he was okay.
Did you ever touch him sexually?
Never.
Next time on Intent, the Tex MacIver case.
Does this mean Tex is walking?
Not necessarily. It means that they're considering it, but it doesn't mean that they've made their decision.
Intent, the Tex MacIver case, is a co-production of Volt Studios and 11 Alive WXIA News in Atlanta. Will Johnson and Brian Weiss are executive producers with Volt Studios. Reed Redman produces, researches, and edits the podcast. Richard Humphreys at Tacoma Media in Silver Spring, Maryland, mixes and edits the show. You can find me on Facebook at Caitlin Ross 11 Alive or on Twitter at Caitlin Ross 1.